You're listening to the Write Project podcast and radio program, a show about writing and modern Newfoundland author culture. This program is produced and recorded at CHMR FM 93.5 FM in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and is aired on other great stations in the province and elsewhere in the country. It can also be heard online at www.chmr.ca. I'm your host, Matthew LeDrew. Before we get started, though, on August 14th, you're all invited to the Wikipedia Editathon, NL Writers Edition, at Munn's QE2 Library in the computing classroom on the first floor. Wikipedia Editathons are events where a group of people meet up to edit and grow a specific subject on Wikipedia that has noticeable gaps in it. Our topic will be writers of Newfoundland and Labrador. The purpose is to make significant historical writers who have been overlooked more easily found and researched, while also teaching those who attend how to use the Wikipedia platform. Although we will have mainly collected research on past writers, many of whom are now deceased, we encourage you to bring any knowledge or research you have about any Newfoundland writer, living or dead. Our goals for the event are to create new Wikipedia pages for NL writers who don't currently have one, edit current pages that are lacking details, add names to the category writers from Newfoundland and Labrador to create a more complete list, and teach attendees how to use the Wikipedia platform as an editor. This event is brought to you by WANL, the Writers Alliance of Newfoundland and Labrador. If you'd like to sign up for the event or learn more, please email student@wanl.ca. Computers will be provided, and there's no need to have any prior knowledge of editing. We're here with Brad Dunn. He is the author of After Dark Vapors, which comes out in October 2018 from Engine Books. How are you today, Brad?
I'm good, man. Good. Thanks for having me in.
No problem, no problem. Thanks for coming on. Excited about the book. It looks amazing.
Thank you.
What literary pilgrimages have you been on, if any? Have you gone on vacation to write?
The first one that I can think of was when I went to Ireland in 2007.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I lived in Ireland for the summer, and I actually read Ulysses when I was there.
Cool.
And there was a cool event. Ulysses, the whole story is that it takes place during, like, one day.
It does?
Yeah, so, like, the plot is that this guy relives the adventures of Ulysses or Odysseus through modern-day Dublin over the course of 24 hours. And I think that's June... It's either June 12th or June 16th, one of those days.
It actually gives you the day that it takes place over?
Yeah, so on that day, every year, they have what's called Bloomsday after the main character, and there's all kinds of different like events throughout Ireland. And I was living in Galway, and Joyce's wife, Nora Barnacle, was from Galway.
Now, you said a moment ago that you were in Ireland. I'm catching you in a lie here, because Galway is just outside St. John's there.
Well, the original Galway.
Yeah, I know.
West coast of Ireland.
I'm being silly.
No Danny Williams, no Danny Lynn. So she was from Galway, and her family home has been turned into like a little museum.
Okay.
So I went there on Bloomsday, and there was like a lot of like Joyce fans there, a lot of literature fans, and we all did readings of like the different books and stuff, so that was really cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. Other places, like I've been to Greece. That was awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. Germany.
Wow.
I got to see the castle. We're like...
You are way more well-traveled than me. I went to... I've been to Avondale.
Nice. Avondale's beautiful.
It is gorgeous. Yeah.
And in Germany, I saw the castle where like Snow White, I think, is based in there.
Really?
Can't remember. It was some famous one of the Grimm fairy tales and the castles.
Like whatever castle that drew inspiration from the castle in that story.
Yeah, I just saw it on the train though, but... Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's really cool. All right. That's insane. That's a lot. That's a lot. That's no one's going to top that answer. That's going to have to be the last one.
Yeah. I was in Paris too, and that would be the last one. And I went to the Shakespeare and Company, where like all the modernists used to hang out.
Wow.
In Montparnasse, I think is where it was.
Yeah. Okay.
And obviously, like everywhere in France, or everywhere in Paris, especially, it's. Famous writers used to drink here, so come in and spend extra money.
Yeah. Hemingway was here. There's a drink named after him.
Yeah, that's the fun. Actually, I think I used this line in in After Dark Vapors where one of the characters goes to Paris, because I had this experience.
Yep.
And you go to a bar and they're like, yeah, Hemingway and Joyce used to drink here, so they feel like they can charge extra for the drinks.
Yeah.
I was like, well, these guys were alcoholics. Yeah. Like, they drank everywhere. So yeah. Don't feel so special.
Yeah. Like, that's fair.
I'm sure there's a bar in Idaho where he used to get drunk too, so.
I can't get over that there's a whiskey, like that he had, there's a Hemingway whiskey, and I'm like, this guy was an alcoholic who eventually killed himself, guys. Can we maybe not? Like,
man, yeah. I know. I was here in Cuba in the winter, and there's like a lot of bars where it's like, oh, he'd come here and drink this type of drink, and you know, Hemingway's such a brand, though.
It is.
It's like, I think there's a, you can get like a catalog of like African adventure themed decor.
Yep.
And it's called like the Hemingway collection.
Oh, God.
And it's kind of like, you can kind of imagine the kind of seats and stuff. And,
yeah, I can, you know, see it.
Very, like, yuppie kind of lifestyle.
Perfect.
I'm going to be going to, I go on a lot of tangents, so.
No, that's fine. Tangents are great.
Man, even here in Newfoundland, you can go on some great literary pilgrimages. You can go to Fairyland.
Fairyland, yeah.
Like, if you're a fan of Wayne Johnston.
Yeah.
Because they got, like, Baltimore's mansion there and stuff. And obviously Fairyland, I mean, there's...
Yeah.
Not only is there Wayne Johnston, but there's also Joel Hines.
Yeah, Joel Thomas Hines is
nephew. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of great artists in Fairyland. So, I mean...
There's a...
You don't have to go to Greece.
No, on the Cape Shore, that's where Amanda's books are written and stuff like that. Yeah. You can go down there. Gros Morne's a great spot just to sit and be relaxed and write if you want to get stuff done and be cut off.
I think there's like a writer's retreat in Woody Point.
Interesting.
That I think is like very popular.
What is the first book that ever made you cry?
Good question. Oh man, what was that one? It's like the kid gets the two beagles. It's like Red Fern.
Nope.
Something like that. I'm going to look it up on my phone because... Where the Red Fern Grows, a children's novel about a boy who buys and trains two red-bone coonhound hunting dogs. Yeah, that's the one.
Okay.
I read that book when I was like 10, I think. And I think something happened. I can't remember exactly, but like, spoiler alert.
What's it about?
One of the dogs dies. Okay. Something like that. Man, it's been so long, like 20 years ago. But is that like one of the dogs, or if not both the dogs, die? One of those type of things. And I've always loved dogs.
Yeah.
So that's the earliest one I can think of that would have made
something
me cry.
About a dog die. Any dog where a dog dies is a bit, there's a moment there.
Oh yeah. It's like kids' books back then were so much more intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like the old school Pixar kind of thing.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and Don Bluth movies before that, like the All Dogs Go to Heaven, Land Before Time, Secret of Nim, like not afraid to go a bit dark in your children's lit.
I think, too, like, I think around that time, I would have read Narnia for the first time. So, obviously, when Aslan, when he dies, and, I mean, that's obviously very emotional, too.
He comes back, though.
True, yeah.
That's an unrealistic lesson to teach a child.
But I didn't realize it was an analogy for Jesus at the time.
Yeah, there is that. Does writing energize you or exhaust you?
I would say it exhausts me, for sure.
Yeah, you start it with a bunch of energy and it slowly burns out.
Yeah, I definitely feel, but it's like a good exhaustion. Like, yeah. I compare it to like a honeybee. Like, a honeybee goes around, gathers all this pollen, and then like lets it all go and turns it into honey.
Okay.
That's how I feel. Like, I have all this like stuff pent up in me.
Yeah.
And so then when I write it out, I feel like very, it's like a release.
You're letting go of that weight.
Yeah, I find, like, I try to leave, like, a little bit in the tank, because if I write myself out totally, it's so hard to start again the next day.
Yeah.
So I try to find this point where I can say, okay, like, I know where the story's going to go, so I can pick it up the next day.
Yeah.
Because if I push myself, like, totally exhaust myself, then I can't start again for, like... days, because then you got to get the momentum going again and everything.
No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. I set myself like word limits, like that I try to reach, not only so I can stay productive, but also so that it's not just a lower limit, it's also an upper limit where I'm like, I don't want to burn out.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've abandoned the word limit idea. I definitely try to avoid like getting into the numbers. That was something I learned when I wrote my master's thesis.
Yeah.
Because it's just like... Like, I would get way too hung up on numbers, and, like, when I wrote After Dark Vapors, which is my first novel, at one point I was like, okay, like, I want the novel to be about 80,000 words. I have 20,000 words right now, so if I want to finish the 60,000 words, I got to write at this pace. Mm. And I just, like, I'd be writing, and I would just, like, oh, I got to hit this number, I got to hit, and it just really, like,
got me. You're thinking of the numbers and not the story.
Yeah, it just really got in my head, and I just sort of let it go and said, you know, like, even like, it's not even like about time, it's more like a feeling of like I've hit the wall.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And that's when I kind of check out.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah,
absolutely. What are common traps for aspiring authors or writers?
Oh man, so many. I think that, well, like I just said, like getting too bogged down with the numbers was one big lesson that I learned. If you were like me, when you just first started and you have no idea what you're doing, the big hurdle is just to get started.
Yeah.
For me, like, where I come from an academic background, I wrote my master's thesis before I got into, like, novel writing and stuff. There's such a temptation to, like, bury yourself in research.
Yeah.
And especially if what you're writing about has any kind of, like, real world correlation.
Yeah.
And the temptation is like, well, I'm going to research this. And then the rabbit hole never ends. There's no end to the research you can do on some of these topics, right? And so you need to just start writing and not feel like you need to give yourself permission in terms of like how equipped you are to start.
Yeah.
I remember, like, number one, there's the research, but also, like, I got really bogged down with thinking, like, I have to read all these classic great novels before I'm allowed to write. Like, I have to read Dickens. I have to read Hemingway. I have to read Joyce.
Which is an interesting fallacy, because by definition, Dickens didn't read Dickens.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, yeah. He wrote Dickens without having read it, yeah. So why can't you?
You know, and I mean, now it's like, you have access to so many extraordinary writers now, and like, I mean, Dickens, it was like, he didn't have translations of any of his, you know, European compatriots. Nope. I mean, I don't know if he was influenced by, like, any French writers, or if French writers were influenced by him, or, you know, but it's like, now we have the complete translations of
everything.
Of Kafka and Dostoevsky, and it goes on, and South America, and now there's Africa, and, yeah, you know, it's coming everywhere, and it can be very overwhelming, and if you're in any way reticent and feel like you're not ready, that, yeah, can just be overwhelming. So definitely the trap is feeling like you're not ready to start, whereas there's never going to be a point where... And then even then, it's like, well, I've written my first novel,
yeah,
and now I'm drafting my second, but I'm trying not to write the same book again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the process is still totally new. Like,
is it a direct sequel, or is it a different thing?
Totally different story, different cool characters. And, yeah, I just feel like a virgin all, yeah, over again. Because, you know, on the one hand, you learn a lot of great lessons, but it's still a new story, still new things to research, still a new style you have to develop. So,
yeah,
you know.
What was your master's in?
My master's thesis in philosophy.
Okay.
And I did it on poetry and Plato.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Here at Mun, too.
Mun is the spot. Does a big ego help or hurt writers, do you think?
I feel like probably better to have a big ego than be painfully insecure.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think this is just, like, true in life, really. Because, you know, the process of writing a novel is going to, like, chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
I don't, like, whoever you are, if you're going to try and really challenge yourself, you're going to be humbled by the process. If you're not humbled, that means you wrote a really self-indulgent,
yeah,
and crappy book. But I feel like it's easier to be brought down than it is to have to build yourself up to that.
Yeah.
Because if you come at it and, you know, you have all these insecurities, you're not sure if you can do it, then that first wall is, yeah, going to hit you hard. And, man, if you can't push yourself through it, then it's going to defeat you. Yeah. Whereas, you know, if you got that big ego and it humbles you and brings you down, yeah, at least you have something to work with. But man, if you got to build yourself up, that's tough.
I don't know where I'm at on that. Like, I don't know. You seem like a pretty humble guy. You seem like pretty down to earth. But like, I don't know where I fall on that scale, because on some level, to put out your own stuff, like to honestly say that my imaginings are worth you paying money for and reading, takes an ego in and of itself. Oh, the 100%. Fact that any human can say, you should pay to hear what comes out of my head.
Yeah.
It's better than what comes out of your head.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of insane, and it's an insane form of commerce that we've created as humans, where thoughts have monetary value now. But at the same time, like, when I'm talking about my work, it's clear that I have no ego about it at all. Like, I'm clearly egotistical enough that I've put it out there, but I'm humble enough to go, here you go, it's very bad. I hope you don't like it.
It's a weird, like, megalomania. It's kind of, it's a paradox, because, yeah, like, on the one hand, I feel like you need a lot of, I don't know if it's confidence, or, like, you need that dialectic between, like, confidence and insecurity, because I feel like, if you were a stable person, you probably wouldn't want to be a writer.
No.
You'd probably have some sensible, you'd probably be a lawyer or like, you know, the carpenter or something, but
literally anything.
So on the one hand, it's like, like you need a bit of that insecurity, a bit of that chip on your shoulder, but also you need that confidence to stick through it and deal with all the hurdles that come along your way.
What is your writing kryptonite?
My cell phone, I will say. Getting distracted by Twitter or Instagram, my friends' group chat, just getting pulled into something else and losing my train of thought. That usually takes the wind out of my sails.
Yeah, that'll do it. How do you select names for your characters?
So, I don't like to do the, like, what's his name in Lost? Christian Shepherd, like the overly allegorical names.
Christian Shepherd.
Yeah.
Wow. I've never watched that show, but that's on the nose.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the book Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson?
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. You know what the protagonist's name is?
What is it?
Hero protagonist.
Well, I feel like that's a little, like, joke.
Is it, though? Yeah,
well, so I don't... they kind of... Sometimes I'll, like, just leave it as TK, like, to come.
Yeah.
And then a name will kind of just present itself to me sometimes. If I feel like I'm really drawing on, like, a person that I know,
yeah,
I'll use their name. And then...
Change it after,
something like that.
Ask forgiveness, not permission.
Yeah, and use their middle name, yeah, something like that, you know?
Yep. One of my authors, we were chatting about this question, and they actually said something interesting. They put a lot of thought into their characters' names. I don't. At all. I put a lot of thought into character, and when it comes to name, whatever sounds cool if they're an important character. If they're a not important character, who cares?
Yeah.
They were saying they have a logic to it wherein their nickname, like the character's nickname, says a lot about who that character is. Because chances are their friends or whoever gave them that nickname, so it reflects their personality.
Yeah.
But whatever their name is reflects back on their parents, reflects on how they were raised, reflects on the last generation. So if you've got a stereotypical Christian name, then you probably, like a biblical name, that's a signifier that you came, whether or not you are or not, that's a signifier that you came from a household that was into those things.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. I think I probably would have, that would have been something that I considered, but probably wouldn't have never, like, verbalized.
Yeah.
Right? I think at one point in After Dark Vapors, I have a character who's comes from that kind of, like, upper middle class background.
Yeah.
I think at some point I might have Googled, like, what would have been upper middle class names at this current point in history, and, you know.
Yep. Yeah, I use a lot of Google. In fact, like, it comes to a point where it starts to think that you're having a baby. Like, it'll start to come up with, like, you're on some baby name registries that it starts to come up with, like, ads for diapers. And it's like, no.
Oh, yeah. Google, we've externalized so much of our brains to Google. But I feel like as an author, you should have those instincts anyway. Like, if you're writing about a character in 19th century England, you probably wouldn't name him Billy Bob.
You might. You know? That'd be funny. I kind of like that, actually. That sounds like a lot of fun, to write a period piece and consciously write all the characters so that they have names that they would not have had in there, just for comedic effect.
Yeah.
What's your name, Tim?
Yeah. Definitely, like, it, you know, names definitely give a flavor, especially when you consider, like, regionality to names. If you start giving your character, like in fantasy, if you give your characters, like, a certain nationality that has a certain cadence to it, like, and especially now where, like, I think a lot of fantasy writers are trying to get away from that medieval England style.
It's so hard.
So, like, what's the great one of the great ways to do that is to use names that aren't Bartholomew.
Yeah.
Edard.
It's the Arthurian influence, yes, on fantasy, exactly, is still very there, and it's one of the things that I like. I like when people get out of that in the genre. Like there's only so much experimentation you can do when the setting is predetermined.
Yeah. Like, I feel like even if you use so many of those conventions, but then you give characters, let's say, like, African style names, that will give such a different, like, flavor to the story. Yeah. You know, something to think about.
How long on average does it take you to finish a novel?
I think ideally I'd like to spend 3 hours a day writing, like just pure uninterrupted writing. And then it took, all said and done, I would say, if you took all the, like, stops and pauses when I wrote After Dark Vapors and you condensed it, it probably took me about a year to write it.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's a good length of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That means you can write approximately 20 before you kick the bucket, because we're authors. We'll go young.
Yeah, it's funny, eh? When you think about, like, how many you got in you.
Yeah.
You know?
That's soul-destroying when you start counting down from, like, how many you've got left.
Yeah.
And you question all the days last year you spent not writing.
Yeah, you probably a good idea to start carrying around, like, a memento mori or something to remind yourself, you know, like, I'm 30 years old now, so, I mean, if I got to 70, that's 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, you do the math.
Yeah.
You know.
Not enough books left.
Exactly. But then maybe we'll find some kind of cure to all our diseases.
Yeah.
You know, by the time we get that age.
Or you'll get big and be able to do more than one a year, like King, where he can just sit there and just churn them out.
Yeah, I feel like that's almost the opposite problem.
Where without ever once thinking of an ending.
Yeah, and that guy, I wish he'd spend some more time editing.
I do.
I love Stephen King, but man, like, I've read his most recent novel, The Outsider.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm just like, man, you need an editor. Like, yeah. I don't know, like, I guess there's no one.
Can you, I mean, you do some editing work. Yep. You've done some work for us even over it so far, and we're going to get you to do more soon. Because it was wonderful. But it's got to be hard to edit King at this point. Like, can you imagine if you got hired to do that right now? Like, how do you say to King, you know, maybe all your characters don't need to be authors?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much repetition in this novel. I can't imagine anyone didn't realize that.
Yeah.
He's writing for a major publisher.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they have great editors.
One would hope.
Why isn't anyone saying, hey, you don't need to repeat this for the fourth time? I think the reader understands the plot. Like, and it's the same when I read George R. R. Martin. It's like, is there no one telling you to, like,
you don't need to describe this every down, single man. Meal?
Like, yeah, you don't. I know you have this nice reference material you want to show off, but, like, you don't need to spend a whole page describing Tywin Lannister's armor.
Yeah.
You know, like, totally interrupting the battle. Like,
yeah. It is a major issue with both of them.
So is it, like, that's what I would love to know, is that, like, is it that these publishers are afraid of their authors? Is it that the authors don't want to hear it? Like,
I don't know. Maybe. It's entirely possible. There's also some, I mean, once someone sold, you know, hundreds of millions of copies doing one style, then it's like, well, clearly it works, so let's not mess with it.
Yeah. Even if. That's a good point, too.
Realistically.
Yeah.
Like, you can find flaws in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, the editors are employed by the publisher, and the publisher just wants to make the money.
Yeah. I almost wonder if that's more of it, is that we don't want to accidentally kill the golden goose.
Yeah.
It's like Stephen King, just let him off the leash. Mm-hmm. Let him just write whatever nonsense he wants to write.
There's that famous Family Guy thing where he's like, it's a killer lamb.
There was a story, I remember someone asked him, maybe it was about that Family Guy episode, and they said, you know, it's one of those, like, where do you get your ideas?
Yep.
And there was a story where he's like, I was washing the dishes, and I thought, what would happen if a finger just started coming out of the sink? And I wrote a story about it.
Yeah.
And it's like, the guy tries to cut the finger off, and like, all of a sudden, it's like, that's how he writes, you know?
Yep.
And it's just, I feel like there's no block between what his brain says and what his hand does.
Yeah.
It's just pure output.
Yeah.
Like, it just goes out, you know?
Which is admirable in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, if I had that image of, like, the finger coming up, and I'm not saying I'm better than King by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But that would be something that I would file away and I would put in a story. Like, in a larger story with themes and stuff like that, I'd do a thing where the character has an anxiety dream, and that's the anxiety dream. And I would put all that same cool imagery and stuff like that in there. But,
But, you know, it's...
It's hard to criticize because he's him, you know what
if
I mean?
If you don't like the kind of stuff that Stephen King writes and you want to be a writer, I would still suggest reading Stephen King, because it should embolden you to just chase whatever insane idea that pops into your head and see where it goes.
I wrote my thesis on The Dark Tower. I mean, there's, as much as I find flaws with a lot of his work, that's one thing that I'm like, no.
Yeah.
This is everything.
Like, my favorite Stephen King book will always be It, because it was such a special, like, I read it at such a, like, special time in my life that it really, like... I think I was like 13 or 14 years old and feeling like, I've never read anything like this.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were allowed to write this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the real book will never be turned into a movie.
Well, it can't be for a few scenes. Really can't be.
There's one, I mean, the infamous, like...
We know the scene.
The infamous scene that I'm sure people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But there's other stuff, like crazy parents getting possessed by Pennywise and throwing their baby in the toilet.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, you could never put that on television.
No.
You could never put that on screen. Like American Horror Story pushes the envelope. They'll never have something like that on it.
No.
You know? And, you know, and that other scene included, it's like... You could never write that unless you just turned off that inner editor in your brain. And it's like, you know, that obviously goes too far, but then I feel like that, at the same time, that brings with it all the great scenes with Pennywise and all the great stuff that King does. But, you know, it would be nice if you had an editor every now and then be like, well...
Maybe you don't need to do this.
Maybe we don't need that.
Steven, did you think of an ending before you started writing your ending?
Yeah.
Have you ever read Needful Things?
No.
Oh my lord, the ending of Needful Things. Read it just for the, like, because you're, I mean...
That's a newer one, right?
No, that was late 80s, early 90s. But when you're writing, when you're watching a movie or reading a book, you can't help but your brain has a predictive nature to it.
Right.
So you see things happening and you guessed, okay, based on the dominoes that have started to fall, here's where I think's going to go.
Right, yeah.
And in a good novel or a very well-written novel, then there'll be a twist at the end, but the dominoes, it'll still have a cause and effect motion where it's like, oh, the ending still makes sense. It's just not what you thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
King's endings, man, it's just like... Set the dominoes up, set them going. At the end, completely ignore the dominoes, get at your chest set.
Yeah. He's got a thing about endings. I've seen a lot of interviews where he talks about like endings.
Yep.
I know that Irving writes his endings first.
Sounds like a good way to do it.
And Stephen King apparently thinks that's like absolute blasphemy. Like, he's like, I save my endings till I get to them. Which is probably why they're so crazy.
He doesn't save them, though.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I guess this book's done now.
Yeah. On to the next one.
Like, Needful Things, spoilers, ends with a sheriff making shadow puppets to scare the devil out of town.
Right.
Like, he just, apropos of nothing, just makes a dog as a shadow puppet, and the devil runs away.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's the stand with, like, the hand of God and stuff. And, yeah, that was ill-advised.
There's so much that's ill-advised. All right, thanks for coming in, Brett.
Oh, thanks for having me.
No, no problem. So, everyone, mark on your calendars to check out After Dark Vapors, the horror literary novel about werewolves coming out October 15th, 2018. And it's going to be amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you.